Welcome to this post-election town hall, a special presentation of the Commonwealth Club's week-to-week political roundtable. We're very glad you're all here. It's a full room. People are watching us live online. Hi, Mom. It is now just a little more than a week since the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States. Something that this is the president-elect, yes. Well, he was elected as president. This is something that left
don't
many...
Don't rush it, she says. We're just still going through grief.
Well, exactly. Lots of folks, Republicans and Democrats and independents alike, many of them just surprised and even shocked. I like to remind people at times like this, keep a level head. So first, everyone, just take a breath. Breathe in, breathe out. Tonight's program is going to be part discussion and education and part Lamaze class, so we'll get through this together. Thanks for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week, and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. In this town hall, we will look at what happened. We'll look at what's happening even right now in Washington and New York, and we will try to talk about what can happen next, what to expect, and what you can do. Now, I know San Francisco and the Bay Area well enough to safely guess that probably most of you, many of you, are Democrats or Democrat-leaning, but I also know there are Republicans here, both of the never-Trump variety and Trump supporters. You're all welcome here. The Commonwealth Club is a home for everybody, and I would ask that any comments made here in this forum obviously keeps everyone in mind. As for us up here on stage, any opinions that are expressed are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists tonight. I'm going to start here on my left with Melissa Kane. She's a political analyst at CBS San Francisco, and you can follow her on Twitter at MelissaKane1. And on my right, for the first time on our week-to-week panel, is Jennifer Granholm. She's a former governor of Michigan, co-chair of the Clinton Presidential Transition Team, and she's a political contributor to MSNBC. She's on Twitter at Jen Granholm. So there are question cards spread throughout the room. Please use them to write down and send forward some questions. I will do my best to ask as many as I can during our hour here together. We also look forward to, well, actually, I know you've already had a chance to talk to each other out in the during the social hour, but we'll try to share as much of our hopes and fears and information about what's actually going to happen. So let's go on to the roundtable. And first, I want to start this conversation by asking for your reactions and thoughts on what happened last week. And let's start with you, Governor Granholm. When did you first realize that Donald Trump was going to win the election?
Like many people, I learned about it. I was at the Javits Center in New York on election night. And I was merrily doing my thing, going on TV at 9 o'clock at night, saying, oh, yeah, we're still going to win. Michigan's looking good. And it wasn't until I saw Nate Silver's projection go from whatever it was, 65% likely to like 5% likely, that I realized, oh, you know, we lost Florida. I felt, okay, we could still do this, you know? And when we lost North Carolina, I was like, when we were having trouble in Virginia, I was really getting nervous. And but it was at that Nate Silver moment, even though Nate Silver got it wrong too, right, that I realized, oh my God, this is actually happening. And I was not the only one who realized at that moment. It wasn't like there were some secret internal, you know, polls that showed she was going to lose. You know, I mean, we knew it was going to be closer than it was going to, than it would have been before, like the Jim Comey letter, the second one that dropped. But it was that it was that night, yeah, realizing that the, you know, the tinfoil confetti or whatever it was that was supposed to be the facsimile of the glass coming down was not going to come down. It was a really, and I'm sure for many of those in this room, it was a really hard and harsh realization.
Melissa Kane, you, of course, are part of the liberal media establishment. I'm sure you got all the secret information.
Lamestream media, yeah, right here.
What was it like, and when did you first realize this is what's happening?
Well, so, you know, when the results start, I was in the newsroom, and, of course, the results start coming back. And it's commonly the case that The initial results are skewed more conservative, right? Because the places that count quicker, basically, are smaller towns and more rural places that often are able to get those results in quicker. So it's not uncommon to get some sort of rightward-leaning results that come in first. So it starts happening in the newsroom, and everyone's looking at me. What's going on? I'm like, ah, it's fine. It's fine. You know, when the cities haven't weighed in yet, when they, you know, when you get to the larger places where there's more people, it just takes longer to count. It'll be fine. So we're going, and yeah, and so Virginia's looking close, North Carolina's looking close, and Pennsylvania is even looking close.
What's
and we were actually on set. We were doing, it was myself and Phil Mateer and the two anchors were chatting about sort of what's happening, and here's the results that are coming in. And as they're coming in, we get word that Wisconsin has now been called. And that was it for me, because then, you know, she doesn't get, at that point, she needed Wisconsin and Michigan, and she, without Wisconsin, like, that was kind of it. And I actually said, without Wisconsin, there's almost no way to do this. And about 2 seconds later, Podesta comes out, and so we immediately cut to Podesta coming on stage at the Javits Center saying, everybody go home, the fight's not over. So then we start chatting about that, and just, like, immediately after that, the anchor next to me, and we're on TV live, says, and we're just getting word that Hillary Clinton has called Donald Trump to concede the race. And it was just like, oh, be cool. You know, just, don't freak out. You're on camera. So having to go through that experience right there, trying not to betray anything like surprise was a little difficult. But it was a crazy thing to sort of see these dominoes fall the way that they did when all night we had just sort of been thinking, oh, well, as soon as the urban areas come in, it will turn, but it didn't.
You know Hillary Clinton personally. How do you think? Do you think she knew it up to the last minute, or?
No, I think honestly, we were all totally stunned. I mean, really. So I was the co-chair of the transition team, right? And don't even get me started about Donald Trump's transition. But anyway,
we'll get there.
Yes, let's.
Okay. but you know, we were totally, and perhaps I was more so in the mindset of, you know, we got this, because I've been focused full time on what would be happening after the election, right? Not, and I mean, I had a leg in both camps, but really my primary focus was how to set up a government after the election. And so we just did not know. We knew it might be closer than what all on my team had been hoping. You know, initially we were hoping we'd take the House. There was a moment where we fantasized we might be able to take the House too. That was before the Comey stuff. But nonetheless, we thought it was going to happen, and we thought we would be taking the Senate as well. But was not to be.
It did come down to where we were all, whether you were watching Fox or MSNBC or CNN, you're all watching Michigan and Wisconsin, which is great because I'm from Wisconsin. She's the former governor of Michigan. Mm-hmm. When you were kind of watching, you know how they start breaking down, well, this county, you know, and this one has, did all of that ring true that the talking heads, sorry, on TV were at least pointing to kind of the right areas?
Yeah, they were absolutely pointing to the right things. But Wayne County, which is the county in which Detroit sits, that's the county that always comes in last. It always comes in last. And it's always overwhelmingly Democratic. And, you know, I had my people, I was talking to my people on the ground, you know, how does it look? Are there lines? I mean, what are you feeling? And my sister-in-law actually was doing those, you know, drive-arounds in Detroit, making sure that people, she says, I see lines, I feel good about it. She said, but the campaign manager told me just to be a little bit cautious in telling you to be super positive about the numbers coming out of Detroit, because we're just a little tentative. So, and I was talking to her just before I'd gone on the air, because I didn't want to be like, oh, we got this, you know. And so I said, you know, well, the numbers are looking a little slow. I mean, we'd seen, you know, reports of the Wayne County numbers being down, the numbers in Detroit being down. And turns out, you know, that she got 77,000 fewer votes in Wayne County than Barack Obama got in 2012, 77,000 votes. And they're still counting in Michigan, and it's around 12,000 that she lost the state by. And she got that 77,000 fewer votes. It's not that those votes went to Donald Trump. They just didn't show up. So there's a lesson there for Democrats, I think. And then the other piece of Michigan, mm-hmm. which of course was the overwhelming surge in the rural counties and the outstate counties. Obviously, Macomb County we knew was going to go to Donald Trump, but this is the other delta that was that is troubling, and it's replicated both in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio. It's the fact that in 2012, Barack Obama lost the non-college educated white voters by 19 points. So we didn't win them, we lost them by 19 points. And Donald Trump won them by 39 points. Oh. So there was a 20-point delta there that we lost by. So those two things, the not showing up and the fact that we lost those white non-college educated voters by so much, that is the explanation in the upper Midwest, I think.
I don't have as many contacts in Wisconsin because I wasn't the governor. I like to think I'm a future governor, but I'm not announcing just yet. But I'm actually from Green Bay, Wisconsin, which is kind of, if you will, in a swing county in a swing state. And they went for Trump. And my mother ran a polling station at St. Paul's United Methodist Church. And she said that, 2 days later, after she had finally gotten enough energy back, she said they normally get 300 people, and they had 800 people.
Wow.
Out of something like 1,031 potential, and that didn't include the mail-in and early voting. Yeah. So they had a surge of voting there, and it certainly ensured.
And that's interesting, too, because the early voting, I mean, Michigan, for example, doesn't have early voting, but it has early absentee voting. So you could do, they do a lot of ballot chasing, but you have to have a reason why you're not showing up at the polls. So it's not no reason absentee unless you're a senior. But nonetheless, they have a lot of them out. And Democrats had by far swamped Republicans in the early voting. And that was true. That was true even in Iowa. And we lost Iowa by such a huge amount. So it was deceptive, all the early voting stuff. And there's a question about whether we cannibalized the vote, right, by having it go early rather than on election day. But all the indications were not what the result was.
One of the questions from the audience is one I want to put to you. When people have looked at, the big cities and areas where you would expect the African-American vote, the Hispanic vote to come out, and they often are since then have been asking, okay, was this voter suppression? Did all of these motor voter laws and all these other things, or not lack of motor voter laws, and registration requirements, did that keep down the vote in certain areas? Do you think so, or is that kind of a
It may have to a small degree, but I'm not sure it did to an extent that the vote would have been different.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like enough. There were a lot of lawyers standing by on like 1-800 lines. Both parties had like a 1-800 Republican, 1-800 Democrat, basically to call and report irregularities at the polls. We do know that there was some confusion in places like Connecticut and Texas who have new voter ID laws, and so that was being reported. But had there been something that was so overwhelming that it would have changed the direction of the election, the winner would become the loser. I think we would have heard of it because, again, there was a lot of resources on both parties put to this. And while we did get some reports of some confusion and some problems, nothing has so far risen to the level of actually changing the outcome at this point. I don't know if you...
I totally disagree.
Oh, okay.
Good.
I think there's so many complicated factors, yeah. Right? And I don't know whether it would have changed the electoral vote because in North Carolina, for example, we do know that the polls, the early voting was cut off by a week. They reduced the number of polling stations. They finally opened it up. There was a big surge, but you don't know, right, how many were not cut off. But in the states that used to be monitored under the Voting Rights Act, there were 868 polling sites that were shut down. 868 polling sites. So, if you're not hugely motivated, then that could be, you might decide. I mean, especially I would say for students, for students, if it's not easy, you know, and they don't have transportation and all, you know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons, then it becomes really tough. I mean, in Wisconsin, she lost by 27,000 votes. I don't know what the numbers were out of Madison, et cetera. I would love to, I mean, obviously the 27,000 wouldn't have been overcome by that much. But you know, I this incremental carving away or making voting difficult in all of these states, I think has an impact. And I think it is wrong, it is anti-democratic, it is anti-American to deny people the ability to exercise the franchise.
Oh yeah. So to be clear, what I was talking about was unlawful activities, like actually, you know, people being prevented from voting by somebody at the poll.
And there were worries about that leading up to it, that there were going to be the armed monitors, if you will. And I don't recall seeing any reports of that actually happening. Did either of you?
I don't think so. I mean, I think both sides had poll watchers that sort of, you know, stand off, you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's get into more specifically some of these, I was going to say hopes and fears, but I think many people, it's been mostly fears lately since the election, have had about what is going to happen, what could happen. Let's just kind of, I mean, there's a long list of them. Some of them came up during the election, issues of the treatment of women, worries about, I mean, there's now a lot of news stories about registration of Muslims. Obviously, you know, deporting millions of people, undocumented immigrants and such. So let's talk a bit about this and, I mean, where do you even start? I mean, there are a number of questions on all of those. Let's go to you because you've run campaigns your own and you've been involved in other campaigns and you've been obviously observing and commenting on politics for a long time. How much of what Trump said during the campaign about some of these things do you think will carry through into actual implemented policy, and how much of it was, I'll say whatever I need to do to get the vote?
I hope none of it carries forward, but I worry that his supporters are going to hold him to it, and there's a lot of members of Congress that are among the you know, the anti-immigrant, for example, deport people crowd. You know, did any of you see the Leslie Stahl interview on Sunday night? So he seemed to be, you know, he's tried to come across as much more, you know, moderate or whatever. But you know, underneath it all, he was basically saying we are going to deport people with criminal convictions. And there's no distinction there that the people who may have criminal convictions, the criminal conviction is just coming across the border. And that's the conviction, as opposed to murdering somebody or something like that. I don't think any of us would have a problem with that. But if your only conviction is coming across, then, you know, what's going on here? So, I mean, I'm sure that there are many in this room who have family or friends that are in the population of undocumented. And this is really existential. I mean, all of these kids who are in schools, who are crying. My daughter works at a bilingual school, and I can't even talk about it really because it's so upsetting. She's so upset for these kids and for the staff and for everybody who feels like, oh my God, I'm going to be ripped out, or my parents are going to be ripped out of their home. I mean, it's so horrible. Anyway, I don't mean to recite all of the parade of horribles. I'm just saying that I worry that he's got to follow through on a couple of these things. And I hope that he doesn't follow through on almost anything he pledged during the campaign.
How many of you are concerned about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act? I mean, that's something they're already, you know, promising to do something about, and Congress has jumped on that. Do you know what we can expect from that? I mean, what can be done? I mean, what's realistic?
Well, so there are a couple of things. So there's sort of what politically he could do and what sort of actively he could do. I mean, right now there's a lawsuit that's pending in a circuit court where Congress sued President Obama, saying the executive order authorizing some funding, authorizing federal funding or federal incentives for some insurance companies is illegal because it was through an executive order, it didn't go through Congress, right? So there's that lawsuit. So the Congress basically won at the lower court, and then President Obama appealed it. Now, President Trump could come in and just drop the appeal. And then all of a sudden, you now have imperiled some federal funding, some federal subsidies, basically, to some insurance companies. So there, it can be as easy as that, as filing a, hey, we drop our appeal.
Yeah.
And then it can be as complicated as, you know, trying to phase out Obamacare and trying to phase in something a little more palatable. I was listening, there was one expert on NPR this morning who was saying that we probably won't see any real changes until 2019, that we kind of have a funding structure in place that's probably going to carry us through, unless Republicans are really interested in just throwing a lot of people off of insurance, which I think even Donald Trump isn't, then they'll probably start moving to in a different direction in 2019, so that we're probably pretty safe. There's something resembling Obamacare will be in place until then.
And politically, they don't want to do anything before the 2018 midterms that would make it look like they're heartless or something.
Exactly. I mean, you can imagine the stories.
Saying, right?
That would come out. So you could do, it could be as quick as day one, filing a, hey, we're not appealing anymore, to a gradual implementation. But to your point, I think they will probably opt for a gradual implementation, because even people who don't like Obamacare, you know, like some parts of it that they want to try to keep together. But, you know, that raises an interesting issue for Democrats, right? I mean, do you fully cooperate on that, or do you sort of dig in your heels and say, you know, no changes? And that's something the Democrats in the Senate at least still have some ability to do, because it's not a – Republicans don't have a filibuster-proof majority over there.
Yeah, I mean, and the Democrats were proposing to make some changes to shore up Obamacare. There's always some stuff you can do to make it better. But to me, what kills me is they want to keep, you know, the candy and get rid of everything else, right? But it doesn't hold up that way, right? You can't have people stay on your health care till they're 25 to have young people stay on, and you can't have everybody with pre-existing conditions stay on without having a big pool of people to be able to pay for that, right? And the mandate is what creates the big pool of people. So it doesn't, you can't have your, you know, your dessert without your vegetables. So it's not going to, I mean, and of course there's no, other than saying that they want to eliminate the geographic barriers of states so that you can buy insurance across state lines, which doesn't get you to what you need to get in terms of the size of the actual pool if you've got competition. They haven't said what they would do to replace it, and because it's hard.
One thing that could affect us here in San Francisco specifically, fairly significantly on the financial side, is the controversy over sanctuary cities. Mm. Speaking of promises he had made during the campaign, one of them was to, you know, end federal payments to cities for cities that were sanctuary cities. San Francisco, of course, famously is one, as Chicago and New York and many others are. What do you think that's something he? I mean, it's, what was it, about $1 billion that San Francisco would lose? I think one of the other cities was like $5 billion that they could lose. Are those too big a numbers for him to go through with on that threat, do you think? Or does that make it so juicy he can't stay away from
it? I honestly think, I mean, his predilection, he's an authoritarian figure, right? Which means that if you're an authoritarian, meaning that you like a police state, you like authority, you like, right? I mean, that's what building the wall, that's what making sure that we're all about law and order and all of that, building up a big military. So I think that eliminating sanctuary cities goes right in the heart of that. That's sort of on the one hand. On the other hand, and on that one hand, is that the sanctuary cities, a lot of them are in Democratic-leaning areas, and so who cares, right, if you're them. However, there is this really important thread inside of the Republican Party, which is a very, very much a federalist thread, or a thread of states and local, you know, allowing states to do and localities to do what they want. So it would be, this is one of the rifts, I think, inside of the Republican Party that we're going to be seeing play out, is how do you have, for example, the libertarian strand of the Republican Party coexist with the authoritarian strand of the Republican Party. They're inside of a container that makes it very unstable. And that's going to be a series of arguments I think you'll be playing out over the next 4 years.
How do you think San Francisco would respond to, specifically in sanctuary cities? I mean, you know, the, I mean, Mayor Lee, and I mean, it's actually something that the progressive...
Really? How do you guys think we'd do if Donald Trump said, or his administration said, you guys got to start turning people over? Here's the thing. How do I say this?
Just say it.
Okay, here's it. So... Look, immigration is a federal authority, right? I mean, there's a lot of law to establish that that's sort of their bag. And you can't deputize, you can't make our cops into your, you know, ICE enforcers. And there's a lot of cases that say that. Like, you can't, the federal government can't rely on, like, the sheriff to, like, do their job. So if you ask, you know, Mayor Lee or Gavin Newsom or one of these guys, they'll tell you, look, we've written our sanctuary city laws to make them very, very specifically, like, conform to the requirements. Just so we just do enough and, like, not anymore.
Do they do the hand signals?
And not really more. So it's on the one hand, he's, you know, he maybe wants to teach a lesson or something like that. But on the other, it's kind of a mess. Like, when you go in, it actually is not as easy as, like, we'll just rip away the federal funding. It really is kind of complicated and could result in tons and tons of lawsuits. So if he can achieve what he wants to achieve in terms of locating criminals and deporting them, at least to an extent that kind of gives his voters an example of what they want, without messing with sanctuary cities and getting into that beehive of, like, what's constitutional and what's federal, blah, 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 I think you might go for that. And so it's not – unless the cities really start, you know, giving the finger, basically, to the Trump administration, which I think we've already kind of started doing I don't know that he's going to want to get into it, but if he does want to, it's, you know, that's certainly a lever that he can start trying to pull. But I don't know that he's eager to jump into that fight if he can achieve what he wants without it.
What happens? I'm just curious because I don't know the inner workings here so much. What does the mayor say if faced with a loss of $1 billion? I mean, if that's really the amount, yeah. And presumably that might leverage, you know, some others. What does he say, do you think?
Well, our budget is about $9 billion. So, I mean, that's not insignificant.
The loss of $1 billion is a big chunk.
But that's, you know, that's more than a lot of countries. But actually, so far, the money that they've threatened to keep from us is about $1 million, actually.
Oh.
So it's federal grant. I know. It's like, what?
That's a rounding
error.
That's
like the Post-it budget.
We'll give you that. I mean.
Oh, yeah.
That's
if it's
all you
a billion,
want, that's fine. We'll just send that right back. Because usually it's not like all funding is going to get pulled. Usually the threat previously that we've seen is that you're going to pull grants from the federal government for law enforcement. And so the grants that we get from the federal government for law enforcement add up to about $1 million for San Francisco. That number is far larger for the state of California as a whole. So the state would have a different issue. You know, there's legislation at the state level that, you know, they may want to tinker with because there might be a bigger loss at that level. But from our local level, it's only a mil. It's some highlighters.
Yeah.
But if he was really to pull all federal funding completely, that would be something really significant. But again, I think it's something that it's worth. It would be something that they would wade into very powerfully into legal issues to protect.
If I were a Muslim woman, should I be scared?
Yeah, I think if you're a Muslim, you should be scared because of this, you know, push to register people. I think that is, again, another example of sort of the authoritarian state, right? And I think if you're a woman, you should be scared because he's going to appoint a Supreme Court member that's going to overturn Roe versus Wade. Now, I hope that the Democrats filibuster and say that's not acceptable. This is state, you know, established law. But, you know, not every Democratic member of the Senate is going to be standing up with that, perhaps. So it's just a real, I think if you're a woman or if you're a Muslim, there's reason to be afraid.
Well, and it also seems like, just from reports that we're hearing, that there's been an increase in crimes or assaults on Muslims, on
yeah.
Muslim women in particular. So people, some people feel emboldened by the victory of Trump, that they feel like they can be more public with their feelings, and that they're now that you know there's, you know, millions of others who feel like they do, maybe. So we've seen an increase in those kinds of interactions. So for that reason,
and
as well.
In schools and all of that, I mean, people who feel emboldened. This is what's so disturbing about having a presidential president-elect who is not willing to get up and make a really affirmative statement, as opposed to just answering a question, making an affirmative statement about who we are as a nation. And this is not acceptable. It is not acceptable to bully people. It is not acceptable to go after people. If you're really a leader of all of us, it seems to me it would be really wise for him to get up and make a speech about how important it is to respect all Americans, respect all people who live in our borders, instead of sort of tacitly allowing this to happen, especially in light of the appointment of Steve Bannon as his chief strategist, because that sends a signal as well.
You know who could give that speech really well? Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Along those lines, someone in the audience asks, if any type of registration is attempted to be instituted, would flooding that system work to neutralize it? There actually have been folks saying if they try to do it, everyone should go in and say, yes, I'm Muslim.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that. I'm going to do that. That's awesome. I love that idea. Isn't it?
We've given you one useful thing to do tonight.
That's really... makes me happy thinking of that.
I was going to make a World War II reference. Let's deal with that thing that people have been throwing around online. We're not dealing with Adolf Hitler right now in the White House. We're dealing, or potentially soon to come to the White House. Can we describe what he is and why that's dangerous and why we don't have to go to the Hitler reference, but still be something that would concern many people? Am I making sense?
What do you mean? Maybe you can describe it.
Yes. There's been a lot of, oh my gosh, we've just elected Hitler, and all these things. Well, this is how the Nazis got into power. Well, it's not, but it's social media. And my point, I guess, is kind of people who are concerned about what could happen under a Donald Trump presidency by going to an extreme worry are maybe missing, some of these things that we've kind of been talking about here, actual laws that could be implemented that might not be, the Enabling Act, but that could still be things that, erode institutions of the Democratic Republic.
Yeah, I mean, I understand people seeing these signals, including the appointments of people that have tendencies in that direction to extrapolate, right? This is obviously going to lead to, X, Y, and Z. But I do think that there are really, I think that the authoritarian nature of his candidacy and his now presidency, or at least what he has said he would do. I mean, I would just look at what he said he would do. And that, to me, it does cause you to worry, not that he's Hitler, but that there is going to be a very heavy-handed state. When he attacks the media, for example, and, when they were all in the pen, as they were at every rally, and people come up to the pen and yell Lügenpresse, which means lying press in German. It's what Hitler used to sort of create a state-run media as opposed to a free press. You can understand why people are concerned about it, right? When you see a lot of the language that's being used at those rallies. Now, hopefully, that is all behind us. But I would say this: I'm concerned about what appears to be a willingness to violate what are norms of democracy. For example, the fact that for 40 years we've had presidents turn over their tax returns. I know everybody's been talking about that forever, but now he's in the office, right? And that he's got 400 companies across the globe. And the conflicts of interest that are embedded in that, the potential anyway, is just so enormous. And yet, the lack of transparency You know, I mean, they're basically saying that you're never going to see his tax returns. This thing about the audit is, you know, is a sort of a ruse. You're just not going to see his tax returns. So the fact that there's no transparency and you don't know whether the foreign policy is for sale or not, that's disconcerting to me, that lack of transparency. The fact that that there may be some nepotism involved in the appointments, you know, that's in violation of rules. But what is happening? Or that children may be getting super top secret clearance, you know, and they're running the business. You know, all of that is really icky. And so to me, when I say it's violating the norms, it's violating the norms of allowing us to see what's really happening so we can evaluate. Maybe there's nothing there. But we can then it just leads us all to fantasize about what is happening, right? Without that openness. So you know, Hitler, obviously, that's an emotional reaction for people to say that, and he's not Hitler. But you can understand why people are concerned about the actions and words that he has taken in the past and what they will mean in the presidency.
Along the lines of your comments on the press as well as violating norms, I want to read a quote from Megyn Kelly. She was interviewed on CNN's program with Anderson Cooper, and she has a new book out. But of course, you all remember she famously kind of became the target of criticism of Donald Trump starting the primaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think it was the first debate.
Mm-hmm.
So she tells Anderson Cooper that, quote, Michael Cohen, who is Trump's top lawyer and executive vice president with the Trump Organization, had retweeted, quote, let's gut her, unquote, about me. This is Megyn Kelly saying this. At a time when the threat level was very high, which he knew. And Bill Shine, an executive vice president at Fox, called him up to say, quote, you've got to stop this. We understand you are angry, but she's got three kids and is walking around New York. And he didn't much care. What Bill Shine said to Michael Cohen was, quote, let me put it to you in terms that you can understand. If Megyn Kelly gets killed, it is not going to help your candidate, unquote.
What?
I mean, I said is
let's gut her? What does that mean, like, offer?
Like,
what?
You do to a deer, yeah. So I said, should a Muslim woman be scared? I mean, should
Megyn Kelly be scared?
Should Megyn Kelly, should press be scared?
Well, you know, it's a strange phenomenon. At the Republican convention, we were in a pen, like you are, over on the side. And it's weird because I'm so excited to be there. You know, we're all like in our nerdy way, like, this is so interesting. And then, you know, at various times, speakers come up and they point to us and everyone turns and boo. You know, it's kind of like Pete's dragon, you know, guilty. And you're like, and yet, after the speakers were done or in between speakers when you wanted to go out to the floor and chat with people and, like, get their interviews, they were so nice. And I thought it was because I was, like, because it's a Bay Area press, and I was like, I'm going to get punched multiple times. So, but you go out there and you chat, and everyone's just like, oh, yeah, we'll chat with you and we'll talk to you. And they were super cooperative and eager to be interviewed. So it's what in mass, it seems like there's all this anger. But the truth is if you get them – one-on-one, they were actually pretty cordial. So, look, that's a crazy situation. Oh, although I'll tell you a story. This is weird. The other day we were I just finished a story. We're coming back to the station, and we're about to enter the Broadway tunnel to go down to Telegraph Hill where we the station is. And this guy standing on the corner just, like, random. And, by the way, it's a white van. Like, it was just – you could tell it was a news van because of the satellite, but they didn't know it was Channel 5. They just – whatever, some news man, and he just, like, flips us off, like, the whole way, just standing there on the corner just giving us the bird, and we were like, that's new. Okay.
Probably thought you were KGO, so it's okay.
We're going to go with that explanation and not just a generalized hatred of media. So far, I'm not sure if it's, you know, that it's turned into actual, you know, threats of violence against individuals. It seems like more something that people kind of in groups get together and like to feel good about yelling at. Although it is weird. It's disconcerting. I have members of my own family who I get into debates with because they've seen something on YouTube that is contrary to something that regular news is reporting. And I'm like, but because a guy on YouTube. and then there's, you know, like, CBS or NBC, and then there's like the guy on YouTube. And he's choosing like the guy on YouTube. And that's odd. And I'm not sure where we're going to go with all that. We could have a whole one of these about, like, you know, media and truth and all that sort of thing. But that so far has been the bigger, scarier thing, is having debates again with people who I've known my whole life about who's telling the truth, me or the guy on YouTube.
Once again, I'd like to welcome everyone who's watching our live stream on YouTube. Apparently, I am the guy on YouTube. Well, you kind of hinted at this earlier. I want to talk about the transition. It has been colorful.
Who was going to be what? Can you just tell us, like, who was going to
be? Okay, I know. They've been calling me and telling me.
The governor was the co-chair of Clinton's transition team. I mean, how much did you have prepared even before the election day?
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I mean, the business of transition, just to give you what a normal transition would look like, right? So you really start pretty skinny because you're respectful of the fact that you're not in office yet, right? And so our transition team sort of kicked into gear in August. And so and Trump's actually with Governor Christie, I think, in May even. They were pretty early. And in D.C., there's a whole two floors of a building. Trump's got a floor, and we had a floor of the same building, so you had to be careful when you went up in the elevator that you weren't, you know, giving away state secrets. But they were really secure. It's the General Services Administration. There was a law that was passed, and they have to make space available for the transition teams. So the transition teams themselves, we had a fantastic team, super great, smart people, and you have to work both on policy, so making sure you take whatever your candidate says policy-wise and then say how it's going to be adopted, right? So you ask the right questions about how you take this and make this reality. So all of the policies, and Hillary Clinton had a gajillion policies, and we had to figure out, to triage them, what were the first ones to tee up. She wanted to do the 100-day jobs plan, et cetera. That was my sort of lane, was to work on that set of policies. And then you have a whole team that is working on what the White House is going to be structured as and look like, who's going to be taking what particular position. Do you have, you know, the CEQ? Do you have all these little agencies? Do you reevaluate it? And then you have a team that's working on what is known as agency review. And that's what you're hearing about right now with the Trump team. If you've been watching TV, you've heard that the Pentagon is waiting for them to land because they've got to show them everything that happens. And so, you know, we had 400 people all signed up, ready to go, all volunteers who were going to go into the agencies on November 9th. We had it all ready to go. You know, we had people signed up. We had a whole training that was set. They were going to be given their equipment. The key was going to turn. It was like clockwork. It was going to be amazing. And so it's so interesting too, because I wonder what they were doing. Only because of what you're not hearing, you know. Right. I mean, the fact that that Trump went into the White House and met with the president, and they were asking, well, how many of these people are going to stay? Well, they're all gone, all of them. You've got to populate the White House with people who are going to be carrying out the business, in addition to everybody in the agencies. There are 4,000 appointments that you have to make, and so there's a whole appointments team that's on the transition, in the transition world. So anyway, it's just very interesting to me that it made me think, because at one point in the elevator, overheard was two of the Trump people talking, and one saying to the other, yeah, I guess we're just winding down. And that was like, I want to say, about mid-October. And that was probably when her numbers were soaring, right? And they all felt like, so I wonder if they sort of, you know, they too were as surprised as we were, or at least maybe not as surprised, but they were surprised as well and maybe caught flat-footed a little bit on the preparation.
Or maybe since they started in May, they had like a complete plan, and then in late October, they're like, oh, we're going to lose delete.
Yeah.
call IT. Yeah.
Now they're like, Control-Z.
What do you make out of what you're seeing? It does seem chaotic.
I don't want to read too much into things like balloons. But on election night, when Donald Trump came out to give his victory speech, he comes on the stage, and there's no balloons. There's no confetti that looks like something. There's no band. It did not look like they were ready for a victory party. You know, like Pence comes out and he's like, "You're president." He comes out and it's like, it looks like a, you know, like a PTA meeting. You know, it didn't look, and they were happy and enthusiastic, but I just mean like, it didn't look like they had the stuff, you know, you're supposed to have stuff. You know, where's the stuff? And that's just, you know, again, don't read too much, but it did look like they were pretty surprised, maybe not as surprised, but certainly, you know, had not, you know, ordered cupcakes and that sort of thing. But it's, I mean, we're all sort of, no one knows which promises he's going to keep and which he's not, right? Even some of his supporters will tell you, oh, we don't think he's going to build the wall. Oh, we don't think he's going to really do that. So no one, we're still trying to figure that out. And what's so breathtaking about this, these appointments and this transition team is it's helping to give us some indication. And that's why I think people were so disappointed with the Bannon appointment, is that, you know, one of his very, you know, so he appoints Rice Priebus and people go, oh, well, that's an establishment guy. And then Bannon. And you're like, what is that supposed to mean? And so as these appointments come through, he's giving a conciliatory tone on like CBS, but then he goes and we hear that like Giuliani is being considered.
Giuliani was saying that for sure.
Yeah. A rumor started by Giuliani. that maybe, I don't know, that maybe he might be appointed to either attorney general, and now he's saying, you know, maybe he wants to be secretary of state.
Wait, but you heard right at the end of today, right, that Mitt Romney, right? You heard that, right? That Mitt Romney is flying back in from Hawaii to be meeting with the president-elect on Sunday about Secretary of State.
I'm going to pretend someone wrote this in as a question. in what number or line of succession is the Secretary of State?
Third? I wanted third, too. So Vice President, Speaker of the House. I want to say Secretary of State.
Good question.
From the guy on YouTube.
What a brilliant question.
Well, you mentioned Steve Bannon. So Steve Bannon was the head of Breitbart, which is an alt-right cheerleader, really. He is now in a position he doesn't have to go through Senate confirmation, right?
Right.
He's really in a political position.
Right.
He's the new Karl Rove, Dick Morris.
Right.
Someone asks, do we think, can we expect him to remain there long, or do you think he might withdraw in because of the public reaction?
Oh, no. Does anybody think that he's going to withdraw? He's been waiting for this for decades, right? This is the dream of the alt-right. They are now right at the heart of the most powerful office in the world.
Did the last Comey letter and the Wiener email fiasco hand the election to Donald Trump? And if not, how much did it close the gap? Someone asks. Really asks. I didn't make that one up.
I do think that the Comey, whether it was the last letter or the second to last letter, I think that the email thing, resurrecting it after she had, you know, the day after she had had a fabulous third debate, we saw where her numbers were. They plunged after that Comey thing, which turned out to be a big hairball of nothing. And I think it had an impact. And in fact, Corey Lewandowski today was bragging that the Comey thing actually gave them the election.
Yeah, I mean, but it's hard to know, right? I mean, because the gap was closing a bit.
We're all guessing, right, exactly.
Already, the other thing that also happened around the time was the letters raising Obamacare rates. So parsing that out, how much were just people freaking out about, you know, the increases versus the letter. It's hard to do, but I think it's something that, you know, we'll have pollsters and surveys trying to get to the heart of that. But an impact for sure, but a decisive one, we don't know.
Someone asked something that we were talking about in the green room. How is Hillary doing?
I have not spoken with her personally, but I a good friend of mine who's a good friend of hers spoke with her 2 days ago. And it was before she went on, actually you all saw that she did the speech yesterday. As you can imagine, somebody putting their whole life toward this moment,
twice and losing is a really hard thing.
Do you think she would do it again?
Oh no, I don't think so.
No? Okay, how's Donald Trump?
Well, wait. Let me text him.
Check Twitter.
What kind of question is that? What do you mean, how's Donald Trump?
So we've had a number of questions that I kind of wanted to merge together here, and they're around what does the Democratic Party do going forward, basically? I want to add to that, the Democratic Party had a pretty bad day last week. They
understatement.
Yes, they control how many or how few state governments. They did gain a couple seats in the Senate, am I right?
Yeah, but not enough, obviously.
You're right. They don't control it, but they gained a couple. Then, of course, they have to look forward to losing a bunch in 2018. Mm-hmm. Did they do a net gain in the House? Do we know?
They did.
Yeah, they picked up like six.
I don't even know what the number is.
Yeah, but Pelosi is still minority leader, not speaker. So, are they a strong enough opposition for Trump to even care about? Or will we see more of, we saw New York's mayor, Chicago's mayor, other mayors and city councils making statements saying, we're going to continue to stand up for our values, as opposed to if someone tries to come in from Washington, which is a very American thing to say. You certainly know the Democratic Party. What do you think the party itself will do?
Yeah, we're going through our own evaluation, obviously. I think one of the things that we must be aware of, we've got to be really strong about making sure we stand up for all people, right? That's got to be really clearly, it's ours, it's ours, America's, but it's really, so that piece cannot go away from us, and we've also got to listen to the economic despair that is in much of America, but it's just so acute in the towns that have been killed by trade. And that's just so utterly real to people. And can I tell a quick story?
Please.
So in Michigan, we've got a lot of those towns, right, where we manufacture vehicles and auto parts and other stuff, too. We have the largest manufacturing footprint of any state in the country in terms of percentage of the economy. And at one point in my governorship, we lost a massive refrigerator factory, Electrolux. And it was in a little tiny town called Greenville, and the town had 8,000 people. And 3,000 of the 8,000 people worked at that factory. And even though we went and we put every kind of incentive on the table to try to keep them, zero taxes, we would build them a new factory, you name it, the UAW, who represented the workers, offered massive concessions. The management of Electrolux said to us, there is nothing you can do to compensate for the fact that we can pay $1.57 an hour in Juarez, Mexico, and so we're going. On the last month that the last refrigerator came off the assembly line, the employees had this gathering that they called the Last Supper. And it was like a huge community mourning, right? Mourning. And I went to this, even though I wasn't invited, because I was so obsessed by this notion of what can we do to keep these good-paying jobs here, right? And I went up to the first table, and this guy, it was packed. Everybody's sitting around eight top tables eating out of box lunches, and there's a sad band playing, sad music, sad band. And this guy, he stands up. Ooh, I can't stand up.
Yeah.
he stands up, and he says, Governor, he pulls his two daughters next to him, and he says, I want you to meet my girls. He says, I am 48 years old. And I worked at this factory for 30 years. My father worked at this factory. My grandfather worked at this factory. All I know, he said, is how to make refrigerators. And then he puts his hand on his chest like this. He says, so Gov, tell me, who is ever going to hire me? And that question was asked by everybody in that room that day, and by everybody in one of the 62,000 communities that have lost factories since the beginning of this century. This is real for people whose identity and dignity are pulled out from under them through no fault of their own. And it is something that Democrats, I say this about my party, have got to be serious about. We can negotiate trade agreements that keep jobs in America. We can fight to keep jobs here. We can fight and hold our trading partners to standards that we hold ourselves to. We need to listen to the voices of those who just want the dignity of a good-paying job in America. And that, to me, is the opportunity for Democrats to be broadly inclusive. And that means including those working-class people who feel like we haven't listened to them.
Howard Dean was on NPR the other day. Howard Dean running for the head of the DNC, be the chairman of the DNC. And he was asked, are you doing an autopsy, sort of like the Republicans did in 08? Are you going to do a thing? And he said, no, we don't need to hear about that. And then I interviewed Congressman Jared Huffman the other day from San Mateo. And he said, oh, yes, we are definitely. He said, I've sat down for two-hour meetings already. So I don't know if it's a DNC thing or if it's a Congressional Democrats thing, but there definitely is some reflection happening. I will say this in terms of Democrats in Congress and the Senate. Now, of course, it's so interesting. Every couple of years, the Senate flips, and then the party that's in power complains about the filibuster rule. So now we're going to have a couple years of Republicans complaining about how unfair the filibuster rule is. And Democrats go, no, this is a totally legit, normal thing that we're going to use like every day. So they've got enough to filibuster in the Senate. But on the congressional side, and even on the Senate side, though, I will say this, we have seen in the past, I think we might see in the future as well, times when Republicans need Democrats to get stuff passed. So if you think of things like an infrastructure bill that Trump has said he would like to pass, and that you may see some Republicans who are, there's some Republicans who don't want to spend money on like Zika virus treatment, or prevention. That's how concerned they are with not spending money. So to get an infrastructure bill passed, for example, it may take someone like Nancy Pelosi whipping up as many Democrats as there are to help, with some Republicans get some of those more, populist or Democrat-friendly, let's say, pieces of legislation passed. So there still could be a place for Democrats to fill that gap because, as you point out, there are these fissures in the Republican Party, and to the extent they can partner to make sure some of these things happen, I think that they could still sort of exert power that way. Yeah.
Let me ask you, because this is a question actually quite a few times I've on these cards. The Electoral College votes on December 19th. You know where this is going. First, if I can ask you to keep it brief, because I want to get into a couple more things before we break here. Why do we have in the Electoral College, and can or are they likely to change the outcome of the election on December 19th?
Okay, so let's answer the second question first. The answer to the second question is no. And to be real short about it, here's why. Because the electors, who are these people? In around mid-October, each candidate submits a list. So California, we have 55 electors. So each candidate submitted a list of 55 people. And then basically whoever wins, that list becomes the electors. So who gets to be on the list, right? These are people who are really active in the party, people who volunteer, people who have held leadership positions. For example, one of the Democrat electors on the Clinton side is Christine Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's daughter. So these are party loyalists. These are not people who are going to change their mind at the last minute necessarily. So in those states where there are Republican electors, they're Trump campaign Republican, GOP picked folks. They were on the GOP list, and that's why they got to be electors. And so if you forget all the legality, which we've talked about here multiple times, forget the legal stuff. At its core, the folks that are going to be electors aren't the kind of people going to change their mind. And even a Republican who doesn't like Trump isn't going to write in Hillary Clinton. Let's face it. They'd rather vote for Donald Duck than change their vote to Hillary Clinton. So that's part of the reason why between now and then you're not going to see electors, maybe one or two, but she would need,
38.
38 to actually
just guessing.
She would need a lot more than – are probably going to do this. And so you may get one or two, but not enough to make a difference. So sorry about that, petition signers. That's not a thing. So just quickly, why do we have the Electoral College? Because it sucks, because they're terrible, because they hate us. If you go back to the 1700s, go back to the Constitutional Convention, the reality back then wasn't what we have right now, right? People were more loyal to their state than they were to the federal. It wasn't like this integrated thing where you're like, I'm an American first and a Californian second. No, that was not a thing. It was more like the EU, right? Everybody is Rhode Island was its own thing. And you got to get everybody to agree to this constitution. You're asking a state to give over a substantial amount of power to be part of this federation. Now, in order, so everyone has to sign. So you got to get the small states to sign. You got to get the slaveholding states to sign. And they were nervous. Basically, if you do a popular vote, right, then the big populous states at the time, like New York, were just going to steamroll you, right? And then New York, a New Yorker was going to be the – a New Yorker would always be the president, right, because they had more people. And so you were going to get ignored, Rhode Island, or even Georgia, where you had lots of people but fewer people who could actually vote. So one of the concessions was to build an electoral college, because if you think about it, the least amount of electors you can have is three. That's like everybody gets at least three. And then it goes up from there. So a state like Wyoming, let's give you for example, there's one elector for every 200,000 people. In California, there's one elector for every 700,000 people. Okay, so but this was specifically done to keep a relevance for these rural areas, keep a relevance for these less populated areas or areas with lots of slaves, for example. That's why it's built in, and that was what they did. It was kind of a concession to get the smaller states to sign, because they did not want to just turn it over to a popular vote. If you think about it, you go to New York, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, you know, some of these urban areas, and like, boom, you got all the votes you need to win, and you could ignore the rural areas. At least that's the argument. But historically, that's why that was added to the Constitution.
And that really perfectly matches what you were saying about the, if that wasn't there, there wouldn't be a need an urgent need to address those concerns of the factory workers. You could say we don't need them.
Right. I would say I think the Electoral College is an anachronism now, and that it needs to be. Of course, you need a constitutional amendment, which is not easy. But there's also this movement called the National Popular Vote, which means that if you had enough states that had that together could comprise 270 electoral votes, and those state legislatures signed or passed a law that said that the electors of our state will flip to whatever got the majority at our electoral college. And if you had 270 states to be able to do that, then essentially you bypass the electoral college problem. But we don't have enough states we've got several states. California has signed on, but not enough to be able to flip the electoral college.
Well, I want to do our final bit here with hopefully giving folks some sense of how they can be involved, how they can play a role, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or independent. And it's actually the most frequent question I've seen as I've been reading these, is what can I do? What should I do? You know, there are people who are protesting. There are other people who are just feeling helpless. There are Republicans who fought. I mean, we've had a number of folks from the Hoover Institution who have kind of a core center of the Never Trump era groups. What if someone came to you and said, you know, I really want to do something. I don't want to just, you know, ignore politics for 4 years and then go and vote again. What would you tell them?
Yeah, I actually had this yesterday and the day before. I teach at Berkeley also, and my students, my husband's students actually. I went to his class. He teaches there as well, and they were saying, "What do we do?" And I said, "This is the baton. We're passing it to you. You have got to run for office." These millennials often have seen their future only in the private sector because they hate government. But the good news is that yesterday there was a big luncheon here for Emerge California, which is encouraging women and training women to run. And since this election, they have seen a huge spike in interest of people who are calling saying, "How can I run? How can I run?" To me, that gives me great hope that people are not giving up on democracy, that we are only, you know, I mean, it's such a form of self-loathing to hate government and hate democracy, because what is democracy but us, right? It's us. And so getting, I would say, if you ever feel like you want to raise your hand, God bless you, please do it. I don't care what party you're in. If you feel moved to be able to change in some way something that you find to be unjust, please participate in that way, in whatever way you feel is important. But to me, we are nothing if we don't have participation. This is a participatory sport, politics is, and we want to encourage people to raise their hand to serve their nation.
Any thoughts?
What she said.
Well, I would just add, I knew quite a few folks who in the final week or so of the campaign went and volunteered at their local party and, you know, making phone calls, sending texts, helping out in any number of ways. I was kind of suggesting that if you're really upset, you go there now.
Yeah.
What do you need? I can make posters. I want to run. I can do all kinds of things, because now is when you have those conversations going on of what the party is going to become, and
serve your fellow citizens too. I mean, go to a food bank, whatever it is that causes you to feel like you're keeping up at night. You know, you can act. Action sometimes is the best cure for grief, and at least I find it to be so.
Well, on that note, thank you all for coming. We will be back on December 12th with our next regular week-to-week. You can find our week-to-week news quiz every week on the Huffington Post. Thank you to our great panel today, Governor Jennifer Granholm.
Thank you
political
all.
Analyst Melissa Kane. And thanks to all of you here in the room, watching online and listening online.
All right.
Have a great week.